Welcome, everyone, to episode 61 of Underserved. Today, we are featuring Lance Sleeper, Senior Director of SOC Operations at F5. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Lance, thank you very much for joining us today on Underserved.
I appreciate being here. It's an honor, and I look forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. So let's kick it off with one question I often ask folks. What first got you interested or excited about technology?
I grew up in the era before the internet and before social media. So for me, it really was kind of something that started very early. So I grew up in a very small town in West Texas. I like to look at how things worked. I like to tinker with things. I still do. And my first computer was a Xerox. And it was a Xerox that I helped my dad actually put together. And so back in the day, you didn't buy computers from a computer store. What you actually did was you bought components and you assembled them. And then you had to do the modifications. Completing the first computer I had didn't actually have a hard drive. It had two floppy disk drives. It had a 5 and a quarter and a 5 and a quarter, and everything ran off of those two drives. And, you know, ever since then, I was kind of hooked, putting things together, building your own. I remember my first hard drive that was measured in megs. I thought that was incredible. I didn't think there would ever be a reason to ever have 10 megs worth of storage. And here we are, you know, some number of years later, and, you know, I have an iPhone that has 512 gigs. So, you know, go figure.
Yeah, and a terabyte drive is considered small, especially if you're working with audio or video.
Yep. Absolutely.
So you had the first computer in Alpine that you built together. Do you end up going to school for computers or doing something different in college?
So I originally went to, I attended school at Texas A&M. I originally went to do engineering. And the reason I did engineering is at the time, computer science was a relatively kind of fledgling kind of degree plan and couldn't really figure out what I wanted to do. So everybody told me that because I liked the way things worked, that I should be an engineer. And went to Texas A&M and was an engineer for about a half of a semester, and then realized very quickly that I didn't like math or studying enough to be an engineer. So I walked into the dean's office and handed him a piece of paper and said, look, you don't want me, and liberal arts will take me. And he said, good luck and God bless. With that, I exited my brief career as an engineer and promptly got a degree in journalism. I had always done writing. My dad was an editor. I'd always been around it. I had done it where the UIL, which was our kind of state high school sanctioning body, did it competitively for writing contests. And so that felt like a natural gravitation. And, you know, as I look at that and I look back, what's interesting is I spent a lot of time learning to write. And, you know, everybody always asks, you know, well, you're in IT, but you have a journalism degree. How does that work? And it's like, I communicate things. And one of the things as technologists that we have to do is we have to learn to communicate. But more importantly, we have to translate geek to English. And, you know, that liberal arts degree is kind of assisted with that as I've moved through my career. It's something that I've been able to kind of lean back on and has something that has differentiated me as I've kind of managed to eke out a career over the last 26 years.
So you get out of college and you're all fired up to do PR for a motorsports team, but then what happens?
Yeah. In college, I worked at, there was, there used to be a racetrack at, in College Station. It was called Texas Motor Speedway or Texas World Speedway. It's now long defunct, and I think it's become a subdivision. But I decided that I'd wanted to do motorsports public relations. I enjoyed the PR piece. It wasn't hard news. It was something that I could do without ruining people's lives, which is what it seemed like you had to do as a hard journalist. And so moved to Charlotte, North Carolina to take a job with a PR firm out there. And they were putting together a second motorsports team. Well, I got out there and the sponsorship for the team had fallen through. So I was in Charlotte, North Carolina. I had spent every dollar that my wife and I had at the time to get there. I couldn't go back. And so I had to find something else to do and answered an ad and went to work as a sales assistant for Norwest Mortgage, which was purchased later on by Wells Fargo, and was a sales assistant there. Well, they had just rolled out laptop computers for the sales associates, so the people that sold mortgages. They had desktop computers for the people who did the processing. So the loan, the office handled the loan from stem to stern. You had processors literally on one side of the office and loan officers on the other. And I was the only one who knew how to turn on a computer, much less how they worked. So I started my career the way so many other people do, as I started in support. And so I did desktop support and fixed people's problems and made sure that they were using the computer appropriately and not as a coaster, and replacing keyboards when people spilled Dr. Pepper in their keyboards, and, you know, backing up files and making sure that all of the stuff that should be on there was, and things that shouldn't wouldn't, and kind of got my start that way. And then from there, the bottom fell out of the mortgage market in 97. And so from there, went to Colorado Springs, where my in-laws were living at the time, had a series of temporary jobs, and ended up going to work for MCI doing technical writing, as well as doing server installation. So I could build servers and I could also write. So I would write the instruction manuals for how to build these boxes that were going out into the field. They then figured out that I could talk and I had the ability to translate very technical things to non-technical people. So they put me in charge of a consulting team. And I grew that team between 97 and 99 to 28 people. And we were handling a lot of work out in the Bay Area, working for AAA of California, doing a lot of installs and network updates and process reengineering and some other things that they needed done. It was a consulting gig. So it was like, you know, move from one job to the other. And I had the responsibility for finding business as well as doing work. So I was a player coach. After that, EDS, during the big WorldCom deal, purchased MCI System House, which is what that group ultimately became. Walked into EDS, bought us in May of 99. In September of 99, they came in and said, "You're too young to have this job. We have other people that we'd rather have working that are now on the bench. Fill out this big stack of paper. Welcome to EDS." So that was my first introduction to big IT. So spent the next couple of years kind of bumping around, got transferred to Dallas to work with the MCI account, then got transferred over from MCI into transportation with American Airlines doing all their CMMI implementations. So there was a contractual requirement for EDS at the time to have CMMI level 2 and then progress up through that. I was put in responsible because I understood both sides of it. So they put me in charge of a couple of groups. Things happen the way they do for a reason, I believe. My boss and I did not get along, and I brought up the fact that some of the things that we were doing were probably not the best for the contract. It was a whistleblower situation, so while my boss could not terminate me, they could remove my job, and so they gave me 30 days to go find something else. Well, at that point, I ended up taking on the application support manager role with American Airlines. Under the managing director's name is Daniel Henry, who's a fascinating guy. He's actually the CIO of McDonald's now, who kind of gave me that start and absolutely loved it. I'm an operations person through and through. I've always loved support. So I did that. I did a little bit of application development with the website, moved over within that group. They wanted to build the operations piece out. So they moved me into an application management for application support management for the .com. And then my boss, whose name is Dan Searley, who was running operations at the time, then moved over to the network side of the house, and they needed somebody to run it for .com. I was the only individual contributor who interviewed for the job, and I got it. And built that team from a very small fledgling team into a DevOps organization that was running DevOps 24/7 around the clock. Had the extreme pleasure of meeting one of my mentors. His name is Stephen Leist, who taught me kind of what leaders really, really were supposed to look like up to that point. A lot of the leaders that I had had were examples of how not to be. Daniel Henry was certainly one that I wanted to emulate, and Stephen Leist was by far one of the best leaders that I ever worked for. So worked for them for a while until 2016. 2016, I got the chance to go to a fledgling startup called Shape Security. They kind of invented the anti-automation space, and I was their second signed customer at American Airlines. So I had a problem that they could solve, and it was great working with them because they were very high integrity people. Worked for them. Helped build a unicorn. We sold at $1 billion of valuation, which is exceptionally rare, in January of 20. And at that point, moved over into F5 and kind of have been F5 forever since, building out the SOC operations for their security products group.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Let me back up a bit to your time at AA. You referred to yourself back then as a digital janitor. What were you doing back then?
Yeah, I'm still a digital janitor. So the fun part of operations, and this is something I tell people in the interview with the team, is like, look, you got to understand something. If there's something new and cool going on, we never get to do that. But if there is a mess, if there are fan blades that have to be cleaned, if there is something wrong, we are the ones that call. We're janitors. We clean up other messes. And, you know, I've actually enjoyed, you know, there are people in the IT world who get very defensive about using blue collar terminology for what they do. And I'm actually very proud of it. So my mom and dad were both educators, but my mom's parents were, one was a nurse, the other one was blue collar, worked in the oil field. I did a lot of work with him over the summers, and I've always really identified with that lunch pail, come to work, shirt with your name on it kind of mentality about working. And, you know, when I was at AA, you know, one of the things that I did, and I did very well, and I still do very well, is running incident calls. You know, everything is broken. Everything is on fire, and you've got to figure out what it is, and you've got to figure out how to get it solved. And being able to be calm in a situation where everybody is panicked is something that I feel comfortable with. I don't know what it is. I don't know why I like it. It may be the adrenaline. It may be the fact that, you know, it's challenging, but it's something that I've always enjoyed. The other thing at American that I think was really important in the middle of learning kind of that digital janitorial job is, you know, I was exposed to servant leadership and kind of codified a lot of the things that I had thought about how to lead people and how to build teams. Steven really helped me put that together. And so, you know, you combine those two things together and that kind of makes for that janitorial staff of taking care of other people.
So speaking of taking care of folks, you built out a team, well, in several places in India and kind of challenged some of the norms over there as well, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. So this will be my third role that I have teams that are spread out across the globe. I really reject the terms like outsourcing and offshoring, and because the terms in and of themselves carry a bias that you are in the center of the universe. And the farther you move concentrically away from the center of the universe, the less value that you have. And what I found at American, and especially now at F5, is that the globe is round for a reason. You know, I'm not a flat earther. I don't believe that you get to the end of the world and you fall off. Because if that happened, then I couldn't do my job, because then I wouldn't be able to go all the way around the world. But, you know, people work better when they're working during their normal circadian hours. Now, I have a couple of exceptions of that on my team. I affectionately refer to as my vampires, who love working overnight. But for the most part, people work better during their daytime hours. And you know, one of the things that I found is, while there are significant cultural differences, whether you're in Poland or the Philippines or Thailand or India or California or Texas or Boston, there are some basic things that make us human. And there are basic desires that all humans have to really want to do a great thing, to do something that's meaningful, to do something that provides value. And one of the challenges that I faced in India was it's a very traditional patriarchal society. And I had to fight with my providers there to give me female talent. And I said, look, why are all my teams dudes? There is a need from a problem solving perspective to have a diverse team. And that includes diversity of gender. And they said, well, you know, we find that the girls, and it's like, ooh, that kind of makes me cringe because they're not under 18, but we went with it. If we find that the girls, you know, they come and they work for a couple of years and then they get married. I said, okay, do the guys not get married in India? Because, you know, guys get married in the States. And they said, no, they get married. And I said, but the girls, they go off and they become moms. I was like, that's okay. I said, then I'll take them for the 2 years or 3 years that they have to do amazing things. And there were a couple of pretty tense moments as I sat in India in a conference room full of all dudes and said, we're not doing all dudes. I'm not doing that. That's not how teams work. It's not how human beings work. You're going to get groupthink with that. And honestly, I'm not interested in groupthink. And so through me basically holding purse strings, because I was the customer, I ended up having teams there that were 50% women and had two female leads who led two of my teams. One of them was a tech lead for an engineering team, and the other one was for a testing team, who did amazing, amazing things. And I was able to partner with them in the opportunity, not only for their job, but for my business. And we ended up having more complete solutions because they no longer felt like the conversation was being dominated by male influence. It was a conversation where the unifying culture became us. The unifying culture became our software and our needs for our customers and to take care of that. And it was really, really fun to watch because I would listen to some of my peers who would say, you know, we're using thus and such and we're in India and it's horrible because all they do is they just keep delivering mediocre software. And I was like, well, when was the last time you went? Well, I've never been. Well, why haven't you gone? Oh, well, it's a weird place. Food is strange. And it's like, well, I can tell you what your problem is, and it has nothing to do with your people in India. It has to do with how you're leading. And, you know, of course, that always goes over well. But being able to do that and being able to see the world, I tell people, you know, I've seen places that most Europeans or Americans haven't seen. And the reason is because when you go someplace and you embrace their culture and you embrace the things that are important to them, all of these doors open up and you begin to understand, you know, as a people, as a cultural group, what are the things that make them tick? And it's really important from a leadership perspective. And I'll give you a great example for that. So here in the United States, it's not uncommon if we have a major incident going, if we have something going on, we ask people to work late, right? Stay to get the job done. And for us, there's not a lot of impact on that. With my team in Bangalore and Chennai, if I had asked them to work late, if they work more than an hour, then they miss the bus. And if they miss the bus, they don't normally have cars because the traffic there is atrocious. If you can think about the traffic around the Boston airport on 5 o'clock on a Friday, it's child's play compared to the traffic in Bangalore. The traffic in Bangalore is the biggest nightmare I've ever been in my life. And so a lot of the companies bus people because it reduces the overall crowding on the infrastructure and allows them a good way to do it. And that way they don't have to have huge parking lots. And if they miss the bus, they have to stay at the facility. They had a dorm, like a dormitory style facility at the location because otherwise they can't get home. So asking people to stay late is an issue. I mean, it's a real problem that can impact your team and it can actually drive turnover higher than what it probably should be. The other one is if you're looking at having people who are working on a more European shift or American shift in India, you're not going to get women to do that because of the safety issue or the safety issue at the time. It's been a little bit since I've been there, so I don't know if that's changed. But it was understanding how those things ticked also helped you understand what are the things that I can do as a leader to make their lives better, understand their point of view, but then that also extracts that much more effort out because they don't want to lose being a part of an organization with a leader who cares.
You had mentioned the story before about what happened when the EDS folks came into your prior company. What happened when the Harvard MBAs came rolling into American Airlines?
Oh, Lord. So it's interesting because airlines and you know, I'm sorry, I would never invest in an airline. I've been inside them. I know what they're like. You know, you got 48 to 50% minimum of your costs or fixed dollar costs of hard equipment. Then, you know, you got fuel costs and there's a myriad of issues. So God bless the people that do it because it's very hard. And I think while I was there, we had like 1 year that we were profitable and made money. And most of the time during my career there, we were always in cost cutting or restructuring, or we actually went through bankruptcy. So I was there during the acquisition of American Airlines by US Airways. I know it's been billed as a merger. That's not my perspective. I feel like it was an acquisition. So during one of the restructuring, we had a situation. We had these Harvard MBAs who came in to tell us how to restructure. And I'm not going to mention the name of the consulting group because I don't want to disparage anybody and could be just the people I dealt with. But consulting group comes in and they say, okay, well, you know, here's what you're going to have to do. And they pull out like a 9 million slide PowerPoint deck and start lecturing us on how to run things. And it was a telling versus a listening. So they weren't interested in understanding what the problems were. They were interested in telling us how to fix what they didn't understand. And so, you know, at that point, I raised my hand and said, okay, so what you're really suggesting to do is going to be highly inefficient and it's going to drive more cost and it's going to drive more layers in decision-making if you do this within these groups. And the kid that was there, and I say kid very affectionately because I think he was maybe 23 or 24 and I'm much older than that. And he said, well, the latest Harvard Business Journal says blah, 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 blah. And I was like, you know, I appreciate what you're saying. And I would take you to a drink to explain why you're wrong, but I don't think you're old enough to shave. So I don't think you're old enough to drink. And so this is a really bad idea. And I did get talked to by Stephen for that one. It was not my finest hour, but it was interesting because through my career, one of the things that I've found is that when people want to tell versus want to ask, it causes very bad things to happen. It causes us to make bad decisions about staffing. It causes us to make bad decisions about expenditure. It causes us to make bad decisions about business as a whole. And then we end up in this mess and everybody's asking how we got there. And it's like, well, we got there because we didn't ask, we told. And so that was a very, very, it has really shaped a lot of how I feel about people who have MBAs that don't also have experience, because you have people who have this and education is fine, but there's a difference between being wise and being intelligent. And the colloquialism I've always heard is, you know, Somebody who's intelligent will tell you tomatoes are fruit. Somebody who's wise will tell you it doesn't belong in fruit salad. And it's understanding the difference between those two, because we face those things every day from a business perspective. And there's no amount of education that can really replace wisdom and lessons learned.
Thank you so much for joining this Zoom panel interview for our software development position. My apologies for having to reschedule it 7 times.
Hey, no worries. Ready to get this underway.
Let me introduce the panel members from our company. First is...
Whoever that is, can you please mute?
Sorry, that was me. Mailman's here.
Hey, you guys hear me? You see me? My kid is playing Fortnite and my bandwidth is sapped.
Hey, sorry, I was on mute.
Hi, this is Connor Walton.
Can everyone who is not talking please mute yourself?
Sorry, so where were we?
Yeah, so the main reason I joined was to let you know that I accepted a job offer from your competitor this morning. Sorry, your process just took too long. Laters.
Does this drill sound all too familiar to you? If so, you should call Syrinx. Syrinx helps you complete your projects on time and on budget. So stop the Zoom calls and start shipping code today. Call us at 888-579-7469, option 1, or email us at sales@syrinx.com. That's sales@syrinx.com.
We talked a bit on the pre-call about the mindset and structuring organizations and how maybe coming out of World War II, there was kind of a command and control idea about how to structure a company. But you think maybe it's more like bees and beekeeping at a hive?
I do. I am undertaking becoming an apiist, which is a really fancy way of saying I'm going to be a beekeeper. But as I've studied bees, because people think of bees as this monarchical, you know, dictatorial hierarchy. And the reality of a beehive is the queen is only called that because that's the closest that we have in the English language to be able to describe, because there's only one. But the queen is not the most important bee in the hive. The queen is a bee in the hive who has a job. The hive is actually run by the workers. The worker bees are the ones that run the hive. They decide what they go get. They decide how they feed. They decide how many drones are created. They decide if they get a new queen. They decide if the hive needs to be sealed up. All of this is decided by the workers and by the bees. The queen has an important role, don't get me wrong, but the queen is not the most important bee. And one of the things that I really firmly believe, and like I said, Stephen Leist was the one that really turned me onto this, and Maxwell is probably the key writer, John Miller, is that groups that run more like a beehive are much more productive and your rate of retention is much higher than groups that are run with this 1950s style command and control where it's hierarchical and very formal. I believe in kind of that inverted pyramid management style. So as a leader, I sit at the bottom. All of the people that are taking care of my customers sit at the top. And it's my job to take care of my leaders, and it's my job to take care of my people so that they can take care of my customers. Because, you know, one of the things about Shape that I love is we had what Derek Smith, who was the CEO and now runs a couple of things for F5, would say that we had an irrational dedication to customer satisfaction. And we did some really strange things that maybe didn't make sense from a dollars and cents perspective, but created a culture and a company where we were just devoted to making sure our customers were happy. And that's one of the things that I so took from that, is because Derek, even as a CEO and as somebody who has started and sold 4 or 5 companies now, he sold his first one at 15, has so instilled that, is that when you take care of your people, then your people are very comfortable and then they take care of your customers. And by doing so, it's kind of this weird dichotomy where, while customer satisfaction is the most important, the way that you get that customer satisfaction is by taking care of your people who take care of your customers. And it's almost like, so I love gardening and I'm big into organic gardening. In organic gardening, you don't feed the plants, you feed the soil. Because if you feed the soil, then the soil feeds the plants and you have this healthy ecosystem that continues to generate produce for you. And teams are the same way. You have to feed the soil. You have to feed the people who are taking care of the customers, because then the customers are taken care of. And I've really strived and really worked on creating those cultures. And, you know, one of the philosophies I tell all the people who join the team are, is, look, you always have to have one hand up and you always have to have one hand down. One hand up is you're always looking to learn. You're always asking questions, understanding what you don't know. I've been with the Shape series of products since June of 2016. That's a very long time. And every day I learn something new. And I love that. I love the fact that it doesn't get stagnant. It doesn't get stale. And that's one of the things I tell people is like, how do you know when you kind of made it? And I said, you don't ever make it. You're in security. And security is an industry, and anti-automation and anti-fraud as a whole change on a regular basis. So you always have to be willing to learn. That's that one hand up. One hand down means you always have to be willing to teach. And so I'm brand new here. I just started, but you brought something from somewhere else. You have something to teach us. So we just recently hired within the last, I'm going to say 12 months, we hired some people who came out of GameStop. So not GameStop IT, but like GameStop running stores. And one of the things that they have brought to the team is that customer service mentality and understanding how to deal with upset customers. Because if they're calling us, something's already wrong. We don't get a call from the customer saying, hey, is everything good? Do you have tickets to the show or tickets to the football game? It's something's broken. And one of the things that they've been able to bring is that knowledge from outside, and they're actually sharing what they know about customer service and how to take care of customers, which is a completely different dynamic than you get from most IT professionals because they haven't done that. And, you know, and I've got other people on my team who are from the military, and the military kind of brings that core purpose of mission, objective, team, unit, enemy, and they bring that piece. And so having that one hand down, always being willing to teach, is important really for two reasons. The first reason is because you always have that responsibility and that should always be in the front of your mind no matter where you are. But number two, when you start teaching one another, then you begin to share of whom you are and you begin to realize that this person whose hair may be longer or shorter, or they may have a beard or they may have earrings or they may look like they fell into a tackle box. You know, you have no idea, but they're a human being who has needs and there's things that they want to do that are so critical and important just to that ecosystem becoming one. And you begin to create that unifying culture where you become an us. And it's becoming the us that is so incredibly important.
You mentioned there quickly the fact that veterans are a part of the talent pool. What have you done in particular in order to tap that pool of talent and help include them in IT?
Well, so first of all, I love the veteran talent pool. Now, I'm a bit jaded because I wanted to go into the military. I was actually in the Corps of Cadets at A&M. My sophomore year, I found out that I was profoundly colorblind, and that ended my aspirations of doing anything with the military. But I've always supported the military. It's something that I believe in. It's something I'm passionate about. And so very early on, as I talked to Derek about building the first SOC organization at Shape, I wanted to do it with a focus on military personnel. So in addition to the Corps of Cadets experience, my son is actually in the Coast Guard. So he is serving as we speak. And so I feel like there's some sense of duty to me to be able to give back, because what these kids do, and they're kids, they're like 18 years old when they sign up, is they're signing a blank check up to and including their life to be able to defend the country. Now, how you feel about the military from a political persuasion, you know, we need to set that aside because libertarians will say that we have too much and the right will say we have too little and the left will say, well, what about this? And let's throw that all aside. The fact of the matter is they're giving up their life and the rights that they have, a lot of the rights that they have to be able to take care of our country and keep us safe. So that's something that's always kind of weighed on me. And so when I talked to Derek, actually had a time that he spent in the Pentagon and spent in the defense side of the house with one of his businesses. And so we talked about how was it that we gain that military experience from people who really want to learn. And so what we did is we started an apprentice program. So it's not an intern program. So an intern program, you have 3 or 4 months during the summer or during a semester. The interns come in, they do a project, they present the project, they go back to school. With the apprentice program, what we did is we kind of modeled it after the skilled trade. So think plumbers, welders, HVAC, electricians, where you actually go and you take some basic training and then you go and do the job and you learn how to do the job next to somebody who's more experienced. One of the problems with vets coming out of the military, and this is something that my vets always told me, is look, they teach us how to do our job in the military and spend years doing that. But we get 2 days of preparation when we exit the military. It's a day to get the paperwork done and a day to talk to everybody on our exit interviews. And they don't really prepare them for a civilian life. And so what we did with the apprentice program is we took vets. Most of them are combat vets. There were some that, you know, I've got one combat engineer that works for me, got a couple of infantry guys, but we took vets. And the deal was kind of symbiotic is, look, we need to bring with you your life experience and the things that you've done and how you work within a team and how you understand to deal with adversity. We need you to bring that. And then we'll bring is training in the IT security area, specifically in SOC operations, how to work within a civilian world, because some of the vets are a little bit rusty in how to deal with civilians. and we work together and we teach them how to do the job as we move through that timeline. And what it does is it gives them a chance to be something other than a cop or a firefighter or an EMT, which is what, when they come out, that's what everybody tells them is, well, you can be a cop, a firefighter, or an EMT. And, you know, if you want to do those things, that's amazing. Those are great jobs for people that need them, but not everybody wants to do that. And so what we've done is we created the program. The success rate was right at 75% conversion from apprentice to full-time job. So we ended up with multiple from the Army. We had one from the Navy, one from the Coast Guard, a couple from the Air Force. And it's something where we continue to tap that because they bring, one of the things that's interesting is they bring life experience. And, you know, going back to the conversation about the difference between wisdom and intelligence, a lot of these men and women have been in high pressure situations where they've gotten shot at for a living. So there was one Thanksgiving with one of the, this guy was an officer in the Air Force, and we came back from Thanksgiving and I said, hey man, thanks for working Thanksgiving. I said, I really appreciate it. And he said, well, thank you for giving me a Thanksgiving where we didn't have incoming artillery. Because the last Thanksgiving, he had been overseas in Afghanistan and they were taking mortar fire on Thanksgiving Day. There's nothing that I throw at my vets that is going to rattle them. Because honestly, unless they're in a combat situation, everything else we deal with is pretty mundane compared to some of their experience. So that's a very interesting thread to put into otherwise civilian workforce. Because when people are calm, other people are calm. Human beings are irrational herd animals and they tend to react to one another. And what I've seen is, as we have these crisis situations, and we work in operations in a SOC, so we're always dealing with crises, when the vets are calm, everybody else is just kind of naturally calm, because this is what we do. And it really facilitates a very easy transition for those who are not veterans into these high-pressure situations that you have to handle as a part of being in IT.
I understand when you're away from keyboard, one of your hobbies is barbecue, something that's been a part of your life for a long time. Tell me about it.
Oh, I love barbecue. I actually started cooking with my dad. I think it was around 9, probably around the same time we were doing computers, which was when I was old enough to understand what's going on. I actually still have the barbecue pit that my grandfather built, my dad modified. And I'm getting ready to rebuild for a third time. I think it was built in the late 50s, early 60s. There's something about cooking dead animals over a wood fire that is just exceptionally fragrant and aromatic. So, of course, I'm in Texas. Our barbecue style is predominantly beef, you know, harkening back to the cowboys and the vaqueros who ran those herds up and down. And, you know, one of the things you and I talked about is it's interesting because when you look at barbecue, it's predominantly cuts of meat that the wealthy didn't want. Barbecue is a very working class food, even though it's become exceptionally bougie now. The pellet grill itself, and I have two, so I can't say anything, but the pellet grill has really democratized being able to do barbecue. And there's huge debates in the barbecue community about whether or not, if you're using a pellet grill, if you're doing real barbecue. And, you know, the one thing that I always point out in those arguments, because you have these guys, and they're like 25. When I was 25, I knew everything too. I can't hold that against them. Well, you know, if you're using a pellet grill, it's just like an oven and it's not real barbecue because you're not tending the fire. And I kind of ask, it's like, okay, so did you build your own pit? Are you using a thermometer? How are you controlling your heat? What other technology did you use in putting that barbecue together? You can't be only partially Luddite. You either need to be Luddite and say the only true barbecue means that you built the vessel yourself, you harvested the wood yourself, you cut it down with an axe, you split it with a splitting maul, and the only temperature device that you use to make sure the pit is hot is your hand. And you pull the meat based on how it looks. And by the way, you can't wrap it. Because if you wrap it, you're using paper. And real barbecue doesn't use paper. I said, if you're really going to embrace that Luddite view, then you better take it all the way. Because otherwise, you're just a fraud. You know, one of the things I always tell people is barbecue is about the journey. I know a lot of people who have pellet grills whose meat's horrible. Because they don't understand the process. There is so much more to barbecue than just wood burning and meat being over the top of it. It's about temperature control. It's about wood selection. It's about how'd you pick your meat? How'd you trim your meat? How did you brine it? Did you brine it? Do you inject or not? Cook it hot? Do you cook it slow? The thing about it is there's many roads to Rome. There's a lot of ways to get good barbecue. And the thing about barbecue and the thing I like about life in general is you're never done learning. There's always something new. There's always something different. I remember cooking my first prime brisket. Growing up, there was no such thing as prime brisket. I'd never seen one until about 5 years ago. It was always selector choice. It was always tough as boot leather. And if you didn't cook it exactly right, it was horrible. Brisket is a cut of meat, is the worst cut of meat in the world. And the fact that you got to pay $10 a pound for it right now is just insane. But you cook that first prime brisket, and it's a dramatically different experience than the lower cuts of meat. You know, when you do a rib roast and you do Montreal versus a salt crust versus this versus that, there's all these different levers you can push, and it's just so much fun. The thing I think I love the most about barbecue, and I know that you cook a lot for the office there, I've had a little bird tell me that you are quite the barbecue person yourself, is that barbecue is always about giving, because you never make barbecue just for yourself, because you know what? You've got to cook it in bulk. Barbecue with one rib is horrible. Barbecue with six racks of ribs is amazing. And it's because of how the pit circulation, the air circulation works. Barbecue is about giving of yourself to other people. And it's about giving without any expectation of return, because they can't come into your place and you've served barbecue and it's like, oh, well, let me go whip up some barbecue for you. It's very much about giving. And even if you look at the barbecue restaurants, you look at Aaron Franklin, who is like the modern godfather of barbecue. Even though we've got lots of great places around here, Aaron Franklin is kind of recognized as that person who shares. But you look, Aaron Franklin's got masterclasses on it. He has free videos that he's done on YouTube. He makes ungodly number of briskets every week. They sell for a premium, but after you figure out real estate and taxes and labor and meat costs and wood costs, he's making some, but he's not getting wealthy on it. And all of the barbecue people I know, all of the barbecue people I've met are all very giving people. And, you know, it all kind of ties back into this circle of life where we all try to harvest fruit from the trees that we plant. And if you're planting good trees and taking care of people, then those things, I believe, come back to you. And barbecue is a great way to do that.
Yeah, and I completely agree with the, if you're going to cook one, cook four. We actually got some Wagyu briskets from Idaho and made a bunch of those.
Snake River.
Yeah, Snake River Farms. We made those for Thanksgiving, and I did bring some into the office. Folks here got to try some Wagyu burnt ends. They did get a little bit spoiled. But we also, tradition that my sister and wife came up with a few years ago, we cook pulled pork, ham, and all the sides for a homeless shelter nearby for Christmas Eve.
That is awesome.
Again, kind of playing into the theme you were talking about. If you're going to make it, make enough to share and share it and help people with it.
So I adopted our football coaching staff. Both my boys played football. So for the past 8 years, essentially, I've been involved with our high school football program. And every season, starting from the time they were in junior high all the way up, on the Monday starting the week, I would take barbecue. And that way, because these are guys that are giving like hours and hours and hours of their time, and they're not compensated enough to do what they do, taking care of our kids and doing that. And it was just one of those things where, you know, the first they kind of gave me kind of a weird eyebrow, like, you know, what do you want? I was like, nothing. I like cooking and I want to cook for you. And I did that for 8 years. This was my last year to do that. And it was that same thing. It's just being able to give back to those who are giving to somebody else.
Now, speaking of football, you were an official from Pee Wee all the way up to D1 once upon a time, right?
I was. There was a period in my life that I officiated football. I retired. When I retired from football, I had a choice between, I had three I could pick two. So I had my boys' football, my job, and officiate. And so I picked my job and my boys' football and retired from officiating. I retired when I was in the Southland Conference. So that is the most notable team there is Sam Houston State. There's several others that are in there. The conference is shifting a bit with some of the conference realignment that they're doing. But I did. I started with Pee Wee football and called Pee Wee, called junior high, called some of the biggest games in the state of Texas, some of the big rivalry games. I think the biggest football game from an attendance perspective that I ever called was a semifinal game between, it was Trinity and Arlington High at the old Cowboys Stadium in front of 40,000 people. High school football in the state of Texas is a whole different ball game just from an attendance perspective than it is in the rest of the country. But I love football. And, you know, there's something weird about me that I probably need to go see a psychologist about, because I pick these hobbies and these jobs where everybody's always angry. I have to bear the brunt of that anger. You know, operations is that way. Soccer operations is that way. Football is that way. There's got to be something that's not quite right. But football was really interesting because it was a lab every week in crisis management. The best official in the world can hope for only the best result, which is silence. You know you've done a great job in officiating when the coaches don't say anything to you, when the fans don't say anything. You just disappear and it was like you were never there. That's the best possible job that you can do. But that never happens because somebody is always upset and somebody always knows more about what you do than what you do, which is odd. You know, I often thought about one of the things that officiating really ingrained into me is asking questions. It goes back to that whole ask, not tell, because the reason I got into officiating is I went and watched a game, a high school game before I started. It was a playoff game and the officials were horrible. They were just bad. They were really bad. And I was like, I could do a better job than that. So I did. I went and did it. And I figured out very quickly, it's not that easy. Did I do a better job? I would say that over my career, I think I was a pretty good official. I think I did a pretty good job. I kept my flag in my pocket. I threw it when I need to. I got to call some really cool games. I got to meet some very cool people, but I made a lot of mistakes too. As an official, you know, one of the things you develop is a very thick skin. You can't have very thin skin and a lot of feelings and have what I call rabbit ears and be a football official. Now, I don't know if it's true for other sports, but I did a year of basketball, did a couple of years of baseball, and then did 11 years of football. And I can tell you that you can't have thin skin and be an official, number one. And the second thing that officiating does is it helps you to slow things down and think about what the problem is in order to solve that problem, but do that in real time. That's one of the things really good officials do is they can slow the game down in their head, which gives them extra mental processing time to be able to see what they saw on TV and understand. In fact, as an official, you make mistakes when you rush. If you're rushing, you're going to make a mistake because then you start throwing flags at what you think you saw, not observing something and then ruling on it with the flag. And that's a subtle difference, but it's a big difference. The other thing as an official is it's this kind of circular pattern in my life. Is you're doing something without needing to be thanked. You can't have games without officials. Guys that are, and now women, who are willing to go out and spend, you know, 3 hours of their time so your kid can play a sport, get yelled at, called everything but a nice, upstanding citizen, and then be able to go back to their jobs and everything be fine. You can't have games without officials. Nobody likes officials. We're kind of a necessary evil, but you can't have a game without an official. And the other thing that you learn as an official is how to defuse arguments. There was a great NFL official. His name is Red Cashin. He's since passed. He was one of my mentors. And he always talked about this concept of verbal judo and disarming people. And there was a story that I told you, and I think it's a fun story to tell. So I was at a freshman game. It was a B team game. It was raining. It was cold. It was toward the end of the season. And there were four of us working this game. It was just miserable. The coach on the sideline that I was occupying fashioned himself a modern day Vince Lombardi. Now, keep in mind, he's a freshman B team football coach, a young kid. That means he hasn't learned yet what he doesn't know. But he knows that he'd had a mentor somewhere that just rode and rode and rode and rode officials. So he's working us. He's riding us. He just is like, if he just shut up and coach, he probably would have won the game. But he was focused more on us than he was on his players. And so finally, he just goes off because I'm ignoring him. He's like, you are effing cheating us. It's like at that point, bang, flag comes out. You can call me a lot of things. You're not going to question my integrity. So the flag came out. It's like, coach, that's 15. And he kept on and kept on and kept on. He said, throw me out. I dare you to throw me out. And I looked at him. I said, coach, I said, if I have to stay and witness this travesty, you are going to stay with me and we are going to watch it together. He's like, well, you're the worst official I've ever seen. I said, coach, that would be way too much of a coincidence because of your coaching. And he just paused. He wasn't quite sure what I said, but it completely disarmed him. And he walked back and he started coaching his kids and everything was fine. But it was one of those where it's like, I would never like walk into my accountant's office or go stand behind the person who's checking groceries at the store and start yelling at them that they're not going fast enough or they didn't type in the SKU correctly and just berating them about what they're doing. And it's like, what is it about people when you get sports involved where human beings become this unruly mob, like, you know, almost like the Roman Colosseums, where they're yelling just foul things at the players and the coaches and the coaches' wives. And what possesses you to do that? It's a game. Now, it's a fun game. And in Texas, it's an important game. But as human beings, there's so much more to that. And, you know, I see in my everyday life, especially in operations, people get spun up really, really easy. And it was that training and officiating to understand that, you know what? They're mad at the situation. You represent the situation. They're not mad at you. They're mad at the situation. So if you make the situation go away, then the behavior will get better. But it's one of those things where I tell my teams, like, look, if somebody's rude to you, be nice. This is a line from Roadhouse. If somebody's rude to you, I want you to be nice. They're going to be rude to you again. If they continue to be rude, be nice. And you will be nice until it's time to not be nice. And then that's my job. Because I don't want y'all taking the beating for being not nice. And I've always told the team that when it's time for somebody to be not nice, let me know. And that will be my job. But you will always be nice. And that's tough. That's really, really tough, especially as things get personal.
Thank you, Lance, for joining us today and sharing your experiences and stories with the listeners of Underserved.
I really appreciate you having me. It was an absolute joy, and I look forward to listening to this in many, 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 many more episodes.
Excellent. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved Podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.